The following is For Your Ears Only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Illegal immigrants, student loans, missing jobs. Romney and Obama pitched to key constituencies in the presidential race.
Democracy deferred. Inside Egypt's political turmoil, army interference, what Washington can and should do.
Greece, the euro, and fallout for America. Greek elections put off another crippling financial crisis, but for how long?
Wanted, more support for science. New polling shows that the public appreciates science and its byproducts, but not paying for basic research.
Perfectly Frank, a veteran of TV comedy and stand-up, talks about his obsession with Sinatra and singing so much like him now off-Broadway.
Plus, notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For Your Ears Only, for the week of June 24th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this key quote from last week's news. Everybody was thinking there was something going on, we just weren't sure what. That was Mike Long about his wife's song, Matt, adopted years ago by Jerry Sandusky, and who last week offered to testify that the Penn State assistant football coach had abused him, as well as 10 boys whose similar accusations a jury had already been sequestered to consider. After 20 hours of deliberation, Sandusky was found guilty on 45 of 48 charges. Investigations continue into the possible complicity of others in the Penn State community.
And this coincidentally connected quote, they will no longer get a pass on these types of crimes. That was Duquesne University professor Nicholas Cafardi on a Philadelphia jury finding Monsignor William Lynn, a former archbishop's aide, guilty of child endangerment, making him the first senior U.S. Catholic Church official convicted of covering up priest sexual abuse of children. Now this.
For 2 years, this president had huge majorities in the House and Senate. He was free to pursue any policy he pleased. But he did nothing to advance a permanent fix for our broken immigration system. Nothing. Instead, he failed to act until facing a tough re-election and trying to secure your vote.
If Congress does not get this done in a week, the average student with federal student loans will rack up an additional $1,000 in debt over the coming year.
Mitt Romney beat President Obama to a conference of Latino leaders last week and beat up on him as well, while Obama at the White House played for the support of college students and other young voters. Turnout in both constituencies may be key to deciding November's presidential vote, along with the mammoth escalation of campaign donations and flagging of the economy. To talk about all those factors and other campaign-related developments of the week, we're joined again by Boston Globe Washington Bureau Chief Christopher Rowland. Welcome back to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Some Latino commentators said Romney was still too vague about what he would do about the illegal immigration issue on which he'd been so tough in the primary campaign. And Obama seemed to win that same audience of leaders by stressing his recent decision to provide temporary work permits for illegals brought here as kids. What does the Globe's reporting say about the contest for the Latino vote now?
Well, really what Mitt Romney's doing was trying to soften his stance. I mean, as you point out, he took a very aggressive stance against illegal immigration during the primary. You know, he supports the Arizona crackdown. He has vilified Rick Perry for being soft on immigration during the primary. So what Mitt Romney now in the general election is trying to do is trying to sort of crab back to the middle with, you know, various degrees of success, I'd say, so far. I mean, Mitt Romney has a massive disadvantage in the polls among Latino voters in swing states. Some of the recent polling shows that he's Obama leads among Latinos 63-27, which is an enormous deficit in a crucial part of the electorate. So what Romney needs to do is try to reach out and to try to convince those people that he does have a plan for making a permanent fix.
In focusing on federal student loans, is Obama also hoping to link Romney to House Republicans whose ideology on how to pay for continuing the lower rate has stalled it?
Absolutely. The House Republicans could really create some problems for Mitt Romney if they don't come to an agreement and figure out how to prevent student loans from basically doubling from 3.4% to 6.8% interest rate. It's not just a student issue. This is a middle-class family issue. And if Obama is able to, you know, hang this around the neck of Mitt Romney and House Republicans, it's going to give Obama a big, enormous victory, really. Although, you know, certainly students would lose and families would lose, but a political victory for Obama because he could paint them as extreme.
There's also a campaign element in a GOP-controlled House committee's contempt of Congress vote last week against Attorney General Eric Holder. It cited him for failing to turn over additional documents from the misbegotten Fast and Furious program to let illegal guns go across the Mexican border so their roots could be traced. Do you think that all casts a shadow on Obama or, again, paints the Republicans as more concerned with politics than real problems and policies?
I think this one's a little bit more of a jump ball, frankly, than the student loans. You know, there's a legitimate beef that the Republicans have and that they should be able to investigate this and figure out what happened. You know, that's all Congress's role in oversight is to probe, find out what went wrong. I mean, Fast and Furious was a fiasco. On the other hand, it's not Watergate. So, you know, they have to tread lightly and make sure that they're not trying to, you know, they're blowing it up beyond out of proportion.
Was Obama wise to personally involve himself by claiming executive privilege?
Well, what he's trying to do, you know, I don't know how wise it was, but really the thing is what he's trying to do is stop this, what the White House perceives as a witch hunt that's focused on Eric Holder, the attorney general. The Republicans are really making a lot of hay, and they feel like that they have the attorney general in a weak spot. Obama wants to stop that as quickly as he can. You know, the question is how much the public is going to care about him invoking executive privilege. I mean, after all, Barack Obama did commit to being the most transparent administration ever, and invoking executive privilege makes it look like he's hiding something.
We mentioned the increasing role of increasing campaign contributions now that public financing of presidential campaigns is effectively dead. And some see a ruling by the Supreme Court last week as significantly reducing the ability of unions to collect funds to balance corporate giving. How important do you think that might be to this election?
Well, I think in a practical matter, it's not going to matter that much in this particular election in terms of dollars. You know, I think unions have fairly decent bank accounts right now. But what it signals is that this Supreme Court is, you know, continuing to erode the ability of unions to extract money out of their members, out of non-members and workers and state workers. So over time in the future, I think that it could have more of an effect. It also shows that, you know, they're very skeptical of state rules and union rules that allow, that Supreme Court sees as taking rights away from workers to not participate in certain political activities. So it does spell bad news for unions down the stretch.
It's also possible the Supreme Court this coming week may agree to reconsider the Citizens United ruling that opened the way for unlimited corporate campaign spending under the First Amendment. There's a case coming from Montana where lower courts have openly defied Citizens United. Any decision would clearly come too late for the 2012 election, but do you think we may eventually see a return to the kind of limits imposed after the Watergate scandal 40 years ago?
The pendulum on campaign finance law tends to swing, you know, pretty slowly. The layers of rules and regulations that were built up after Watergate took, you know, 20 years to really get in place, and the limits, and now it's definitely swinging the other way. I would not say that the Supreme Court is going to throw out their, you know, the Citizens United ruling, and that we're going to be back to where we were, you know, post-Watergate. But what you may see is slowly building up more disclosure rules. So while corporations and individuals will be able to continue to provide unlimited contributions to campaigns or to super PACs, I think what you're going to see is that there's going to be more and more rules about trying to get sunlight onto this situation so that the public can see who's giving and how much they're giving.
Boston Globe Washington Bureau Chief Christopher Rowland.
Quote from the news, instead of causing fear, a tragic person emerges. That was a member of the Norwegian prosecution team that sought psychiatric care rather than a prison sentence for Anders Behring Breivik, who admitted killing 77 people to prevent what he believed was an Islamic threat to all of Europe.
Next, democracy deferred in Egypt and Syria. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. So you basically jumped out of the car to see where he was going. That's not fear. You know what I mean? That's one of the problems I have with this whole thing. That was Chris Serino, lead Sanford, Florida police investigator in a taped interrogation of Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman about his fatal shooting of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Now this.
The tumult in Cairo's Tahrir Square again and across the country last week reflected the anger and frustration of a people watching democracy slip away just days after what should have been a history-making first free presidential election. Old regime judges withheld the results of a runoff between Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi and retired General Ahmad Shafiq, ousted President Hosni Mubarak's last prime minister. Transitional military leaders issued a new constitution claiming even more power to protect their interests. And there was confusion about conflicting reports on whether the ailing Mubarak himself was, in fact, alive or dead.
In Syria, meanwhile, escalating violence marked President Bashar al-Assad's battle to retain power. After an Air Force pilot defected to Jordan with his MiG jet fighter, Assad's forces shot down a jet from bordering Turkey, where CIA operatives were reportedly helping direct the flow of weapons to opposition forces least likely to become tools of Islamist extremists. To discuss the turmoil in both countries, what Washington can and should do, for Your Ears Only, we're joined from Cairo by Thanasis Kambanis, a Middle East expert at the Century Foundation in New York and Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. He also writes for the Atlantic Magazine, the Al Monitor website, and ThanasisKambanis.com. Welcome to our program.
Great to be with you.
We know that old-line judges narrowed the field of presidential candidates and that the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces dissolved the previously elected and Islamist-dominated parliament. Remind us of the new powers the military leaders claimed in this constitution that they issued unilaterally.
Well, essentially, what they did in this new temporary constitution was they took for themselves the most important powers that normally rest with the president. So they did everything from the sweeping, which is they reserved for the military the right to veto any declaration of war, to the minor, which is that they created a position and assigned a general to be the permanent budget director for the new president. So effectively, what they did was they took major constitutional powers that set the parameters of the state, and then they also made sure that they controlled the machinery of the presidency so that no matter who ends up taking office, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces will be able to veto everything from his foreign policy down to the nitty-gritty of his national budget.
You say the Muslim Brotherhood did not do much for its own credibility because of the way it exercised its majority power in parliament before it was dissolved. Explain that.
The central power struggle over the last certainly the last couple of weeks, and really if you pull back over the last year and a half, has been between the Muslim Brotherhood and the army. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood has had also its share of friction with the rest of the political class, the other revolutionary forces, liberals, seculars, even other rival Islamists. The Muslim Brotherhood is really the giant here on the playing field. They're the oldest, best organized party outside of the state. So when they came into Parliament in January with really a sort of veto-proof coalition of Islamists, there was a lot of question. How would they behave? Would they govern in an inclusive way that won the trust of other revolutionary groups, especially those who aren't Islamists? Much really to the surprise of some analysts and some Egyptians, they behaved actually like a real domineering, majoritarian, power-grabbing faction. So they went really easy on the ruling junta. They tried to cut deals with army generals. They tried to ram through legislation that was really unpopular with secular people, and really most unforgivably, when it came to setting up the committee that will write the next constitution, they tried to ram through a committee of Islamists, of Salafis and Muslim Brothers, that would completely dominate the process and barely represented the full spectrum of Egyptian politics, much less the ethnic and cultural and gender diversity of the country. And that has really earned them, or rather lost them, a lot of credibility, a lot of the credibility they earned in more than eight decades in the opposition.
There's also some suspicion that behind the scenes, Washington may be providing at least psychological support to the military, which earlier it had pressured to push Mubarak from power. What do you hear?
Well, you know, let's remember that before we talk about psychological support, they're providing billions of dollars in support every year that goes to the SCAF largely through military aid programs. So in many ways, the Washington is literally propping up this regime. And frankly, it's been clear since the Arab uprisings began that America has very little actual leverage and control over its clients in the region. So it seems like America's been on the wrong side of history here in Egypt in its tolerance of the military dictatorship. But it's also during the few periods of time where it's tried to pressure the generals or conflicted with them, Washington has lost. And that happened most humiliatingly for Washington in this showdown earlier this year over democracy workers, including the son of America's transport secretary, who was had a warrant out for his arrest in Egypt because of his work as a democracy promoter in Egypt. And in that showdown, Washington blinked, and the generals were able to have their way and essentially say, look, we're going to take your money, and you can't tell us what to do about anything. Now, in the current crisis over the presidency, the U.S. has tried to sound stern. Hillary Clinton, her State Department spokesperson, came out and made some pointed statements about needing to see a transition towards democracy. And even those relatively muted comments got condemned widely across the political realm here as foreign meddling. And what I think we can expect is, no matter who wins, that the generals and the political class are going to be increasingly prickly and paranoid about anything Washington says, and really uninterested in America's agenda here.
Let's switch to Syria here. Were you surprised to read about a CIA role in deciding which rebel groups get weapons supplied and paid for by others?
I'm not surprised at all. The U.S. policy has been to keep something of an arm's length from the uprising in Syria, but U.S. interests are quite clearly at this point allied against the Assad regime in Syria. But at the same time, there's widespread concern, not only in Washington, but amongst its allies, about the nature of the uprising in Syria. So the patrons in the Gulf, the rich states that are giving money and weapons to the uprising, Turkey, which is on the border, and the United States, and most probably Israel, are interested in minimizing any role for jihadi-type fighters, fighters who are inspired by or allied with al-Qaeda or its type of ideology. So there's a lot of interest in making sure that whatever weapons and money flow into that country flow towards fighters that are allied with political factions that Syria's neighbors and the U.S. Feels like it'll be able to communicate with.
Thanasis Kambanis in Cairo, a Middle East expert at the Century Foundation in New York and Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. He also writes for The Atlantic Magazine, the Al Monitor website, and ThanasisKambanis.com.
Quote from the news, Anna did all of the work, and I got most of the recognition. That was a tribute by the late Milton Friedman to Anna Schwartz, his co-author on the much-claimed A Monetary History of the United States, who died last week at the age of 96.
Next, Greece, the euro, and the U.S. economy. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. There's always a risk, but I believe the benefits are greater. That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, on the controversial publication of a paper detailing mutations that might make bird flu a fatal threat to humans. Supporters said it would allow scientists to identify and protect against that process, while opponents feared terrorists using it to make a biological superweapon. Now this.
The election in Greece yesterday indicates a positive prospect for not only them forming a government, but also them working constructively with their international partners. Now is the time to make sure that all of us join to do what's necessary to stabilize the world financial system, to avoid protectionism, to ensure that we are working hand in hand to both grow the economy and create jobs while taking a responsible approach long term and medium term towards our fiscal structures.
At the G20 summit of major economies in Mexico last week, President Obama reflected a worldwide wave of relief after the election of a new Greek government that was not determined to leave the eurozone and perhaps destroy it in the process. But Obama's call for more global stability barely hinted at the complex financial and political hurdles involved and the dangers of another crippling international economic crisis from which the United States could not escape pain-free.
Despite pressure from other European leaders, German Chancellor Angela Merkel held firm against much more widespread sharing of eurozone debt to help the troubled finances of Greece, Spain, Italy, and others. Moody's Investors Services, meanwhile, downgraded credit ratings of the world's 15 largest banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Deutsche Bank, a move some critics called 5 years too late and not likely to have much impact. To consider these and related issues, especially the dangers to America's economy, for your ears only, we're joined again by French economist Nicolas Veron, senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank and visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me.
What chance do you give the new Greek government to manage both the nation's staggering debt and volcanic public opposition to austerity measures mandated for continuing outside financial aid?
Well, I think it's difficult to answer this question in isolation from the decisions that will be taken by Europe more generally on its framework for fiscal policy and banking policy. Greece is unlikely to meet the current objectives of its assistance program alone, so the question is how are these objectives readjusted or how is a different approach taken? And this question is, of course, less urgently asked under the new Greek government than it would have been if the far left had won the election, but it remains a topical one.
What impact do you see from that Moody's downgrading of so much bank credit rating?
Well, I think it highlights the problems in the banking system more than it creates new ones, so maybe I'm underestimating the market reaction, but I think the truth is that the banking system in Europe is in a very sorry state. The interbank market has largely ceased to function normally, and Moody's, in a way, just highlights this.
Beyond all last week's rhetoric about preserving the eurozone, there were a few measures announced to ease international financial strains. Explain briefly what was done.
The summit has made a lot of declarations urging Europeans to address their problems. But at this point, the eyes of investors are really focused on the summit of European leaders that will happen next week in the European Union. And I think at this point, it's difficult to say exactly what concrete steps will be taken. There is a lot of talk about a banking union, radical measures to have a different approach to Europe's banking system. But it's not clear how fast this will translate into concrete action.
And what are the larger steps that new French President François Hollande and other European leaders could not get Germany's Angela Merkel to support, especially a new form of Eurobond?
Mrs. Merkel is very cautious. I think she's aware that something new will have to be done to prevent contagion from deteriorating market conditions further, but she is very cautious also with her own public opinion. So we've seen this before, of course. This has been the story for the past 2 years, and now the deterioration of market conditions is accelerating. But we're still in that game where Germany resists swift action, and the other countries sort of hide behind Germany because Germany is really the pivotal country. It has all the burden of responsibility, so it creates an incentive for the other countries to just complain that Germany is not doing the job. It's not a very healthy situation, frankly, and I don't know how it will develop in the next few days, but I'm a bit concerned to see the divide between Germany and the other large countries of the Eurozone, France, Italy, and Spain, more and more prominent.
At one point last week, India's External Affairs Minister S.M. Krishna warned that a full-fledged European banking crisis could choke economic growth worldwide. What's your view on that?
I think this has been the concern of basically the rest of the world outside Europe, including the U.S., for at least the past 9 months or so, since the summer of last year when contagion extended to Italy, to a certain extent concerns appeared about France or French banks. there has been a realization in the rest of the world that this was really a major risk, downside risk to a global economy, which is not in great shape already today, but could deteriorate further if things were to go really south in Europe. So you see this sort of warnings coming from China, coming from India, coming from the U.S., of course, since at least September last year. And I think European leaders are increasingly aware that they're making the rest of the world nervous, but ultimately they have to resolve an internal problem. So the expectations from the rest of the world so far remain at the level of discourse and rhetoric, and they're not affecting the European agenda as much as one could hope for.
As far as America is concerned, hasn't all the instability abroad sent more money flooding into U.S. Treasury debt as the safest haven around, even with all our economic problems and political division?
That is true, but it shouldn't be a matter for comfort for U.S. authority, because market sentiment can change very quickly. At this point, the U.S. is a safe haven, but if there is a lot of deterioration in Europe, it's not a zero-sum game. So the U.S. will look comparatively better than others, but there will be negative economic implications as well. So I think the U.S. is right to be very concerned about the evolution of the situation in Europe, even so, as I just said, at this point, it seems not to have a lot of leverage.
French economist Nicolas Veron is a senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank and a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington.
Quote from the news, "It really surprised me because I violated almost every rule they imposed." That was Chinese activist artist Ai Weiwei on being released from a year's probation for good behavior. Though he can now theoretically leave Beijing, he reports continued surveillance and little chance of accepting invitations from abroad.
Next, Wanted, more support for science, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "It's about damn time." That was basketball's LeBron James after leading the Miami Heat to the NBA championship and winning the Most Valuable Player award after 9 years in the league.
And this additional quote from the news, "Long time coming." That was a lawyer for star pitcher Roger Clemens after his acquittal on all charges that he lied to Congress in 2008 when he denied any use of steroids and performance-enhancing drugs during his 24-year baseball career. Now this.
"Hello. I am a scientist, and I've come to improve your situation just a bit. See that fire over there? Have you ever really wondered what the flames are from that fire?"
Science, I think, was something that came from me naturally. It was this general, natural, inquisitive nature that not just me, but all humans share.
In response to a challenge from veteran actor and TV science program host Alan Alda, 800 scientists, science teachers, and others created short films to explain flame to an 11-year-old, answering a question Alda himself had asked at that age. And 6,000 sixth graders chose the entry we just heard by 31-year-old quantum physicist Ben Ames. But for all the attention to Alda's flame challenge, science has a greater challenge. It is a subject of interest and entertainment for millions, and the source of products and processes for millions more, but with not enough citizens committed to funding the basic research required at its core.
Alda recently joined other science celebrities, including Hayden Planetarium director Neil deGrasse Tyson, to consider the problem, as reflected in new public opinion polling coordinated by the American Physical Society, APS. While nearly 7 in 10 voters approved using taxpayer funds for scientific research, there's an even split on the $140 billion in proposed research funding cuts. By 52-48%, those surveys did not think federal funds for research were spent wisely. To talk more about the poll, the problem, and some proposals to deal with it for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by APS Director of Public Affairs Michael Luke Bell, also a professor of physics at the City University of New York. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, David.
First, talk about the most positive poll findings in terms of public interest and support for science, research, and the U.S. standing in those areas.
Well, one of the findings that we obtained, which was not terribly surprising, is that the public overwhelmingly believes that the United States ought to be a leader, a global leader, in science. They also have tremendous respect for scientists and for science generally. One of the surprising results was that even among Tea Party supporters, the public believed that federal taxpayer money was appropriate for the federal government to use for funding scientific research. That was all the positive. People in general, again, just to recap, science is a wonderful thing and ought to be supported, but if you want me to get to some of the negatives now, I'm happy to do that.
Well, yes, scientific research is the second most cited target for budget cuts.
That is correct. That was extremely surprising. And as we probed this, what we were able to determine is that people really don't have a good sense of what science has done for them, except for medical research leading to cures for diseases, diagnostic tools, and drugs. Much beyond that, they didn't see any positive impact, although they were impressed that there was a connection between science and energy, but they really couldn't put their finger on anything specific. And as a result, they had, with limited knowledge, with the government facing stringency in budgeting, science wound up being high on the list for things targeted for cuts, at least in the public's mind.
I know there was talk at this meeting of putting more stress on the commercial byproducts and spinoff that might make people think that this research is important, but that private enterprise should pay for it because these are products that they're buying.
Much of the research the federal government funds is in the upstream research that ultimately leads to products. But at the time the research is being done, those products are not even on the horizon. People don't even think about them. And if I can give you one very simple example, optical pumping led to the development of the laser. The laser was regarded as an invention in search of an application. And today, the laser accounts for roughly one-third, it was related to one-third of the American economy. The laser and the research that preceded it was funded by the federal government because at that time, no one was really thinking about the applications. That came later. Another wonderful example is the iPad. The devices or the components of the iPad, all the result of federal research, federally funded research. It was Steve Jobs' genius to understand how to take those, package them, and make them appealing to the consumer.
Alan Alda is very involved with a program at Stony Brook University on Long Island to make scientists themselves more media savvy, more persuasive, more personal about their work and its results. But others thought scientists should concentrate on science and let media people work out the best messages. What's your view on that?
I think scientists have an obligation to do both. They have to commit their time, obviously, to the research that they do so wonderfully. But they also have an obligation, particularly when they're using federal funds for the research, to communicate to the public the benefits of the research that they're doing or that their colleagues have done in years past.
In relation to media messages, there was talk about escalating the stature of science by escalating paid media campaigns in high-visibility TV programs, even the Super Bowl. Again, is there a risk of trivializing the message coming before or after GoDaddy or beer spots and halftime wardrobe malfunctions?
I honestly don't think so, and I'll give you two examples. Number one, I mentioned earlier that the public does seem to think there's a relationship between science and energy. That is the result of advertising that BP, ExxonMobil, and Chevron have done, making that linkage. So the public gets information from advertising. I think we all have to come to grips with that, even if we don't like it. The second thing is just to refer to a former colleague of mine at Yale, who has been at the University of Nebraska now for many years, who did a halftime spot explaining the physics of a football play before 100,000 fans. That resonated extraordinarily well and generated tremendous excitement about the role of science in everyday life.
Michael LaBelle is a professor of physics at the City University of New York and public affairs director for the American Physical Society, whose new poll found worrisome support for cuts in federal funding of scientific research.
Quote from the news, almost no manufacturer has solved that riddle yet. That was David Sargent, head of auto research at J.D. Power & Associates, on its latest automotive survey that shows increasing complaints about all the new high-tech additions to many cars, though fewer complaints about new cars themselves.
Next, speaking and singing, frankly, as in Sinatra, for your ears only.
A bit more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. She got her dream job and she doesn't want to let it go. That was a friend of Ann Curry, as rumors swirl she'll be replaced as co-host of NBC's Today Show as its lead over ABC's Good Morning America narrows, echoing a slide by long-dominant NBC news programs generally. Now this.
I love what he stood for, and he got me through my life. He got me through my early years.
But through it all, when I ate it up and spit it out. The record shows I took the blows and did it my way.
Carrie Hoffman has had at least two lucky breaks in life. The veteran comedy club owner and TV talent manager has since childhood been able to sing surprisingly like Frank Sinatra. And since Old Blue Eyes died in 1998, Hoffman has been able to exploit that ability for audiences around the country without being beaten bloody by Sinatra fans or flunkies. Began as a show of songs as Sinatra would have sung them and morphed into what, for the last year, in a basement theater that is literally just blocks off Broadway, has become a kind of self-psychoanalysis of fixation on Frank. Welcome to my obsession is the way Hoffman greets his audience.
The show is a testament not only to Sinatra, his inspiring tale of ups, downs, and determined reinvention, but Hoffman's dedication to the man, his music, and the payoff of following a dream. To talk about it all, for your ears only, we're pleased to have Carrie Hoffman on the line now. Carrie, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
You talk about losing your father as a kid and finding a kind of substitute in the singing of Sinatra. Talk about what you felt those first times you heard him on records or on the radio.
When I was a kid, that voice coming out of the speaker of my old RCA Victor phonograph was something that I just couldn't, I still can't fathom. I am 72 years old, and when I listened to Sinatra in 1956, I still am blown away. I cannot believe the sound. I cannot believe the intimacy. I cannot believe the tone, the resonance, everything. But it's more than that. It's something that struck me and resonated in such an emotional way. It was almost impossible for me to communicate to other people. So I guess I started to sing along with it in my bedroom. And that's where it all began.
You were lucky as well to be living with your mom and her musician brothers who could appreciate your talent. In fact, one of them actually accompanied Sinatra.
My uncles were all top studio musicians in the 50s. And if anybody doesn't remember what that was, they were the best of the best. There was a group of about, 1,000 musicians across the country. And whether you were Frank Sinatra, Mel Torme, Ella Fitzgerald, Peggy Lee, those were the musicians who played for all of these guys, everybody. And my uncles were the creme de la creme. The beautiful sound of their instruments entered my brain. And one of my uncles played the same instrument that Sinatra's kind of mentor played, Tommy Dorsey. Sinatra himself said that the sound of the trombone, that kind of long breath phrasing that trombone players have to do in order to make the sound, entered into Sinatra's brain.
At one point, Sinatra lost his voice and had to reinvent himself. Were you aware of it? Take any personal lesson from it?
No. Sinatra lost his voice when I was bar mitzvahed. I was having too much trouble learning my haftorah to even know about that. Sinatra's loss of his voice and the reinvention of a new voice is an incredible thing. Very few people in popular arts have been able to reinvent themselves after what they originally did died. Picasso, maybe. But Sinatra lost his voice from singing too much, smoking, drinking, and aging. And how he reinvented a brand new voice is still really a mystery. There have been theories, and I try to answer the theory in my show, My Sinatra, by saying that he took all the pain and the suffering that he went through, and he put it into a brand new voice. And David, I loved how you characterize my show as a little bit of pop psychoanalysis, because that's exactly what it is.
At another point, you got actually to meet Sinatra himself. How did that go?
That was a real blessing. That was a 1 billion to 1 chance. I had an agent from William Morris, and he called me up one day and he said, come on, let's go down to Jilly's. I think I can introduce you to Sinatra.
That was a restaurant he liked.
Yes. Well, it was owned by his friend, Jilly. And that's where he frequented, and the Rat Pack and everybody, and Shirley MacLaine, everybody. And I didn't believe it. I went down, and as it turned out, the agent was kind of doing what an agent was doing. He was lying. You know, agents do that for a living. And he took me down, and I guess we were just going to go inside and hang out at the bar and hope to meet Sinatra. When, as we descended the steps of Jilly's, there was Frank Sinatra coming out. 1 in a billion chance. I immediately froze, and the agent did not freeze. He looked at Sinatra, and he said, I'd like to, Mr. Sinatra, excuse us. I'd like to introduce you to a young, talented singer named Carrie Ross. My show, My Sinatra, ends with a 5-minute discourse on that meeting and what that meeting meant to me. But he was great. He stopped as soon as he learned that I was a young crooner. He pushed the bodyguards aside, and he started a conversation with me. That's all it took, was for him to know that I was a young singer trying to emulate him as a crooner. And he was just absolutely amazing, sympathetic, gave me advice. I felt like I had been blessed.
Carrie Hoffman's show My Sinatra plays Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays at Sofia's Downstairs at the Edison Hotel on West 46th Street in the heart of the Broadway Theater District.
Luck be a lady tonight.
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only On Air is also online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please pledge at davidearsonly@gmail.com. Mariah Szczocinski of New Jersey did, and we thank her.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly at the Hanger Studio Play It Productions with intern Amy Snopek. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts with support from the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Amy Snopek. The big news this week last year involved administration drawdown plans for U.S. forces in Afghanistan and pared-down plans for Pentagon spending overall, from our June 26, 2011 broadcast hosted by David and Catherine Herzog.
We will bring home a total of 33,000 troops by next summer, fully recovering the surge I announced at West Point. After this initial reduction, our troops will continue coming home at a steady pace as Afghan security forces move into the lead.
More force for more time is, without doubt, the safer course. But that does not necessarily make it the best course. Only the president, in the end, can really determine the acceptable level of risk we must take.
Our challenge will be to design budgets that eliminate wasteful and duplicative spending, while protecting those core elements that we absolutely need for our nation's defense.
President Obama last week unveiled a faster drawdown of his surge in Afghanistan than many military men preferred, citing successes so far, including the elimination of Osama bin Laden, and cost concerns going forward. And Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, had to agree that the president had other priorities to consider. The larger national security challenge, a more cost-effective and affordable military, was defined earlier by CIA Director Leon Panetta, confirmed last week as the next Secretary of Defense.
For President Obama, the quicker drawdown, if carried out, could mean a boost in the polls. A record high 56% in the latest Pew poll favor bringing home the troops as soon as possible versus 39% who favor waiting for stability in Afghanistan. Obama's job approval, on the other hand, averaged only 46% in three recent surveys, with fewer than 3 in 10 saying his policies have made economic conditions better. But he still wins trial heats over all GOP nominees with majorities of 50 to 57%.
To consider the withdrawal announcement, its likely implications, military, economic, and political, as well as the Panetta factor for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, now Executive Vice President of Burke McGregor Group, Consultants on National Security and International Relations. His books include Transformation Under Fire and A Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Easting. Colonel McGregor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
How do you see Obama's plan affecting the Afghan outcome versus more men longer?
Well, I think as you just pointed out, this is a president who follows public opinion. He doesn't lead it. He recognizes that the 20-year period of interventions that we've just been through is now ended. The American public will no longer support it. And so, once again, he's taken a compromise position. He's decided to remove the additional forces that he sponsored unwillingly back in 2008 and 2009. Now, this means 33,000 between now and next year. I would anticipate that more forces will probably leave than that, and that timeline could be accelerated, but he will not remove all of the forces until after the next presidential election.
But some people say that, or some analysts say, that that Obama and many in Washington, in Congress and the military, realize that Afghanistan is not winnable in a conventional sense, that the government under Karzai, the population in its traditions, just can't be put into a secure position except by endless American occupation. And so he's looking at the polls and the realities on the ground.
Well, I think that's true publicly, but I would say that behind the scenes it's much worse. People recognize that Afghanistan is an abysmal failure and an enormously wasteful enterprise. The battle cry on the Hill right now is actually no more Iraqs, much as it was back in 1975, no more Vietnams. Iraq cost us $1 trillion, far more losses in terms of people and materiel than Afghanistan, and we have a government in Baghdad that's hostile to us and aligned with people we don't like in Tehran. No one wants to go there in Afghanistan, and I think people's patience is now exhausted. So clearly, you're absolutely right. Privately, it is actually much worse than people are saying publicly. A third of the country's under the Taliban, another third, no one will do anything without the consent of the Taliban, and the remaining third of Afghanistan is split between Iran and the Karzai narco state.
Do you think the assassination of bin Laden shows that counter-terror tactics with far less manpower can keep Afghanistan from becoming a threat to the United States?
Oh, sure, and that was always true. The truth of the matter is that the Taliban, however much we don't like them, split very profoundly from al-Qaeda in 2001. There was a great deal of bitterness and anger that al-Qaeda, which had been tolerated for various reasons inside Afghanistan, had drawn our attention and ultimately ejected the Taliban from power. We decided to make war on the Taliban unnecessarily, and we've been cultivating more enemies as a result and killing large numbers of people who are strategically irrelevant to the United States.
Can we keep enough men and equipment there or in the region to keep pressure on jihadists in Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan, keep an eye on its nuclear arsenal?
Well, first of all, keeping your eyes on the nuclear warheads in Pakistan is not something you need large numbers of people on the ground in Afghanistan to do. We, the Russians, the Indians, even the Iranians, all have substantial intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets committed to that purpose. Thus far, the Pakistani military has maintained good control of those warheads. Again, the situation in Afghanistan is largely independent of that. All of the problems in Afghanistan, and those, frankly, inside Pakistan, are really local. It's kind of it's a rendition of what the former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, used to say, all politics are local. Well, the problems in that part of the world are very local and have very little to do with us.
Although there are potential threats to the United States in places like Yemen and parts of Africa. I mean, the threat has spread. The franchises have spread from al-Qaeda. And so the local pressure in that area is less relevant.
Well, the independent franchises are there. They're not going to go away anytime soon. Are these necessarily directed at us? To some extent, but for the most part, again, you're talking about internal conflicts. In Yemen in particular, there's an enormous civil war involving both Shiites and Sunnis, involving Saudi Arabia. These are local, regional struggles for power that, once again, don't have a great deal to do with us. Do we need to watch them and manage them to some extent from a distance? Yes. The question is, how do you do that as economically as possible? Because the problem with what we've done in both Iraq and Afghanistan is that it's drained our treasury. We've spent at least $1.6 trillion, and according to Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner, he thinks it's closer to $2 to $3 trillion.
Back to Panetta and the larger defense challenge. First, the wastefulness of much overseas basing. Recently, you called it being mortgaged to our vanity. What does that mean?
We unfortunately have a ruling elite, if you want to call them that, in Washington, D.C., in Manhattan, L.A., to a lesser extent, Chicago, groups of people who like the idea of having American forces all over the world. This sort of global military power complex leads them to see this as a wonderful thing for the American people, as an expression of American greatness. We know from experience that territorial empires were economic disasters, which is why they all fell apart and the original imperialists withdrew. We haven't benefited for many, many years now from the presence of most of our forces overseas. On the contrary, we've absolved others, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Europeans, of the responsibility to invest in their own defense capabilities to become equal allies and partners with us. We've footed the bill. We can't afford it anymore, and I think Mr. Panetta knows that, and I think you're going to see a substantial reduction of our presence overseas as a result.
Retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor is now Executive Vice President at the Burke McGregor Group, consultants on national security and international relations. His books include Transformation Under Fire and Warrior's Rage, The Great Tank Battle of 73 Easting.
Drawdown Defense, from our June 26, 2011 broadcast. The timetable for withdrawal of surge troops from Afghanistan has been stepped up, but with the promise of some lingering presence for a decade. And the need was evident last week with the latest in a recent escalation of Taliban attacks, including an assault on a popular lakeside hotel on the outskirts of Kabul, where end-of-week socializing offended the Islamist insurgents. In Washington, failure of bipartisan budget balancing efforts threatened automatic sequestration of another $500 billion in Pentagon funding that Defense Secretary Leon Panetta called a serious threat to national security. But prospects were dim for congressional approval of Panetta's plan for a new base realignment and closure commission to help reduce a total of 542,000 facilities at 5,000 sites worldwide. I'm Amy Snopek. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, frankly, more Carrie Hoffman.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck let a gentleman see just how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. Lady wouldn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady wouldn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. Let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby. I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see just how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you treated other guys you've been with. Luck, be a lady with me. A lady wouldn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, and it's not nice. A lady wouldn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. Yeah, let's keep the party polite. Never, ever, ever get out of my sight. With me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady.